that some of you are from the workshop on entanglement and emergence, and some of you are not. So I'm trying to pitch this talk at a level which hopefully will be reasonably interesting to both groups. But I did think I should make an explicit connection to entanglement at the beginning of the talk, although this is not quite the language I would perhaps normally use if I were giving it. So let's raise the question. This workshop, I guess, has been pretty much entirely theoretical, and I guess quite a lot of the activity here, which goes on at here at Perimeter, is theoretical. But physics, after all, is an experimental subject, and so it is interesting to raise the question, if I think this is the right way up. It is interesting to raise the question, how would you actually go about looking for some fairly spectacular kind of evidence for entanglement in experiments? Okay, well, we can think of course, different kinds of entangled states, but one of the simplest kinds of entangled state is a GHZ state of the kind which schematically is indicated up there. And you can imagine that we have in microscopic objects, we might think of electrons or atoms or whatever, which can either be in a state where they're all, quote, up, or in a state where they're all, quote, down, or in some quantum superposition of the two, and that, of course, is a GHZ state. And so if we can make N large, then we have a rather spectacular example of entanglement. In real life, of course, you're not necessarily talking about particles being up or down. They might, for example, be at one position or another position. But crudely speaking, this class of large N GHZ states is nothing but what we think of in a somewhat different context as Schrödinger cat-like states. And therefore, any experimental effort to build Schrödinger's cat in the laboratory, and there have been, as we'll see, quite a few such efforts in the last few years, any such effort automatically gives evidence of at least a certain kind of entanglement persisting at a level which hopefully we may be able to call macroscopic. And so at this point I want to switch to the so let's see if that works. Yes, I think not that one, so let's go on. Okay, so let's think a little about the motivation for this kind of Schrödinger's cat-like experiment. We're trying to test whether superpositions of reasonably macroscopic states exist in nature, whether we can see their effects. And why is this interesting? Well, at the microscopic level, we know that the superposition of two microscopically different quantum states is not equivalent to a simple classical mixture of the two states. Now, at the macroscopic level, we can consider formally the possibility of a superposition, let us say, of a state of a living and a dead cat. But we can also consider a situation in which the said cat is either definitely dead or definitely alive. And I'm going to, for brevity, I'm going to refer to the second hypothesis that any particular cat is definitely either alive or dead, as a macro-realistic scenario. Now, of course, there is a very, very widespread misconception in the literature, and perhaps more generally in the community, that somehow decoherence reduces state A to state B. And I believe that's, in fact, a total misconception. If you adopt a particular interpretation of quantum mechanics at the microscopic level, you're not allowed to suddenly change that interpretation radically at the macroscopic level. Most of us would be very unhappy to say that in a simple young slits experiment, each particular electron goes either through slit A or through slit B. If we are unhappy, then we should be at least equally unhappy to say that at the macroscopic level, where the formalism of quantum mechanics unambiguously predicts that the universe is in a superposition of the two states, with the cat alive and dead, we should be equally hesitant to interpret that, the meaning of that superposition, as saying that each cat is alive or dead. That's an old argument, and you know, I've made it many times. I'm perfectly happy to make it again if anyone needs me to. However, I think a much more interesting question is, can we actually tell whether at a particular level of macroscopicness, and we'll come to that in a moment, can we actually tell whether it's description A, the quantum superposition, or description B, the macro-realistic scenario, which is correct? Well, when I say can we tell, I mean can we tell by real experiment? That means we've got to set up a situation in which these two scenarios give different experimental predictions. However, if it's true that by the time we get to the level in question, the given level of macroscopicness, say, that if it's true that by that time decoherence is so effective that we can never see any interference, then of course the predictions of scenarios A and B are going to be identical. And so that's a non-starter. So in other words, we must look for what I shall hereafter abbreviate, QIMDS, the quantum interference of macroscopically distinct states. And that'll be the program I'm going to be talking about. And as I say, if we can indeed obtain evidence for scenario A rather than scenario B at the macroscopic level, then we will also automatically have obtained experimental evidence for a very high degree of entanglement. Now, well, we'll come back later to the question of what exactly macroscopically distinct means, but very crudely, I would like to make my definition depend on having at least two ingredients. One is what I call the extensive difference of the two states, which simply means you have some kind of extensive macroscopic quantity. Could, for example, be the position of a centre of mass, it could be the value of a circulating current, whatever, which is, and that quantity should be different in the two branches of the superposition by some quantity which in terms of natural atomic units is large. That, however, unfortunately doesn't appear to be quite enough by itself. Consider, for example, the neutron interferometer. Then the difference in position of the centre of mass of your neutron in the two branches of your superposition is actually something of the order of a metre, which in terms of atomic units is something of the order of 10 to the 10. However, I think most people would not instinctively regard the neutron interferometer as an example of superposition of macroscopically distinct states. So I'd like to supplement that by what in the past I've called the disconnectivity, and crudely speaking, that should be a measure of the of how large a number of particles are behaving differently in the two branches. And we'll come back, that's a point we hopefully will come back, be able to come back to later. Because the concept of behaving differently, as we'll see, is not entirely unambiguous. Now, the initial aim of the program would be to interpret the raw data in terms of quantum mechanics, and doing that, test whether scenario A, the quantum superposition, or scenario B, the macro-realistic mixture, is correct. Now, this is a program which I and various other people started to propagandize for way back around 1980. And at that time, we got lots and lots of flack. And the flack came predominantly from the traditional quantum measurement community. And they said, really, this is a lot of nonsense. You are never going to be able to do this kind of experiment meaningfully because whatever you do, by the time you get to anything you could call a superposition of macroscopically distinct states, decoherence is going to come in and kill you stone dead. Well, as we'll see, that argument is spectacularly wrong. Let's just now think a little about why. Why has so much of the traditional quantum measurement literature so severely overestimated decoherence? Well, if you look at a sort of typical paper along these lines, it tends to use what I call the electron Sirius argument. And that argument goes roughly as follows. By the time we're talking about things at the macroscopic level, we're talking about many-body systems with some large number n of components, of atomic components. Then the energy levels of such a system are going to be very, very closely spaced. the difference between two neighbouring levels is going to be of the order of a to the minus n, where a is some kind of natural microscopic unit, and n is the number of particles. Now that's exponentially proportional of exponential minus n, and n is of the order of 10 to the 23. So that means that delta epsilon, the difference between the neighbouring levels of your many-body system, is going to be just incredibly tiny, and therefore the tiniest perturbation is going to totally screw up the possibility of ever generating superpositions. And sometimes people would say, if you put in the numbers, then even the motion of a single electron on a distant star like Sirius is going to be enough to screw up the superposition to macroscopically distinct states. So that's why I call it the electron and Sirius argument. Now, as I say, that argument is spectacularly wrong. Why? Well, first of all, there's a rather obvious point. Any system we're going to be thinking about is going to be interacting with some kind of environment. However, the matrix elements of the interaction between the system and its environment will couple only a very restricted set of levels of x. For example, if we're talking about two different states of, say, a billiard ball, just to take an example, then the coupling to the environment is going to be, crudely speaking, only going to be sensitive to the centre of mass, to at least a zeroth approximation. It's not going to be sensitive to the extremely detailed microscopic states of that system. However, that's not the most important point, I think. The more important reason why the traditional quantum measurement literature got it wrong is the existence of what I call false or adiabatic decoherence. And let me give you a formal example of that, and then I'll give you a perhaps more familiar physical example. The formal example relates to the so-called spin boson model, in which I have a two-state system, a spin, coupled to a bath of simple harmonic oscillators. So the Hamiltonian consists of a term for the spin, a term for the environment, and the coupling. And in the standard spin boson model, the system Hamiltonian is just some kind of tunneling term between, let us say, two wells, delta sigma x. The environment is described as a set of harmonic oscillators, and the important thing about this particular model I'm going to take is that in this particular case, the frequency of the oscillators has a lower cutoff, which is much larger than the tunneling rate of the isolated system. And then you have a coupling, HSE, between the system and the bath. So crudely speaking, the system is trying to tunnel from one well to the other, and meanwhile the environment is trying to observe, as it were, localize it in one well or the other. It's a very, very standard problem. But under these conditions, the condition that the minimum frequency of the oscillators is very large compared to the tunneling rate, you can actually make some fairly confident statements about its behavior. First, we start off with the wave function of the universe simply being a product of the system being in, say, the left well, and the oscillators having adjusted to its being in the left well. In other words, the oscillators take their ground state given that the system is in the left well. So if we take the reduced density matrix of the system at time zero, then trivially it just has this form or one in one corner and nothing else. Now let's ask, how does the system evolve? Well, under these conditions, you can fairly confidently convince yourself that what happens is that gradually you mix into the original state, a state in which the system is on the right, that's the minus there, and the oscillators have, again, adiabatically adjusted to it being on the right. And, okay, so the time over which it takes this, generates the superposition, is much longer. I'm sorry, I think there's a typo here. The delta, I can't point, but the delta in the line, the last line there, it should be renormalized, not un. Yeah. Okay. So the time taken is the renormalized tunneling frequency, which typically is much longer than the original one. But nevertheless, over that such a time, you do generate that quantum superposition of different states of the universe. Now, the important point to notice is that the equilibrium ground state wave function for the oscillators when the system is one side is pretty much orthogonal to their state when it's on the other side. Then, of course, there's a function of the details of the coupling constants, so it's a bit exhilarating to that. So that then means that this overlap is of the order of exponential minus the Frank-Condon factor, which is nearly zero. And therefore, if I now take the density matrix of the system, then to a very high degree of approximation, it's simply diagonal with elements of half. So totally boring. Now, if I were to take the prescription, which seems to be at least implicitly assumed in much of the quantum measurement literature, that a complete description of decoherence is given by looking at the reduced density matrix of the system, I would say to myself, at this point, the system is totally decoherent. Nothing interesting is going to happen any further. And in particular, if I wait longer, it's just going to stay in this boring mixture. Not so, in fact. In real life, that's not what happens. What happens is that as time goes on, we gradually, the system, as it were, recollects itself, and after an appropriate period, it all ends up in the right well, as the oscillator suggested. So this says that merely knowing the reduced density matrix of the system without putting in some necessary information about the environment is totally misleading in many cases. Let me give you a much more physically intuitive example of such a situation. Take the neutron interferometer. Right. Got your neutrons spreading apart and converging to a screen giving interference. Now, what is the correct description of the neutron at the intermediate screen? At first sight, you say, well, the neutron is pretty much isolated. I just have to have a quantum superposition of here and here. Wait a moment. That neutron has a magnetic moment. The magnetic moment is interacting with the blackbody radiation field. So when the neutron is here, the blackbody radiation field is doing one thing. When it's here, it's doing another. If I trace over the behavior of the field, because it depends on the exact parameters of cutoff, et cetera, but crudely speaking, I'll find this state is not a coherent superposition, it's just a mixture. Okay? Does that mean the neutron interferometer doesn't work? Of course not. As the neutron beams converge, reconverge to the final screen, the environment, the electromagnetic blackbody radiation field, simply reconverges with it. So we get all the usual results. That's a very, very common situation all over physics, and I'm amazed that it's not mentioned more often in textbooks and so forth, because it's only that feature, really, which justifies applying simple textbook Schrödinger equation quantum mechanics to many physical systems. And that's why, it's precisely this reason why the electron Sirius argument is so totally misleading. So, anyway, as we shall now see. So, let me now go on to specific examples of experiments over the last, most of these are over the last 10 years or so. And these are experiments which have essentially deliberately set out to generate quantum superpositions of macroscopically or at least mesoscopically distinct states and to verify that you do have such superpositions of the mixture states. The first and perhaps intuitively easiest to understand of this set of experiments, first as I discuss it, it's not historical at first, is the beautiful experiments of the Vienna group, Marcus Arndt and Anton Zeilinger and co-workers on molecular diffraction. So this is basically a simple Young slits setup. You have a source, an intermediate screen with two slits, and then a final screen where you look for interference. This experiment, of course, was done with classical light way back by Thomas Young, more recently with electrons, for example, by Dr. Tonemura and various other light atoms. Does anyone know when the first experiment, the first diffraction experiment with molecules was actually done? Any guesses? No? The answer might surprise you. 1928, actually. Esteban et al. With hydrogen molecules. But these are only rather small molecules. And these, the ones now that are being used in the Vienna experiments, are fullerenes, which, remember, are 60, groups of 60 or 70 carbon atoms. And, okay, you don't see quite such a nice, sharp diffraction pattern as you'd see with photons or electrons, but it's still recognisably a diffraction pattern with the usual dips and bubbles and so forth. So it seems pretty difficult to argue against the conclusion that one is seeing a real interference effect here. A couple of interesting points about this experiment. First of all, you might think that in order for this experiment to work, you would need to monochromate and collimate your beams pretty carefully. It turns out not true, in fact. You can actually be quite sloppy, in a sense. You can needn't monochromate at all. The oven does it for you to a sufficient extent. The second point is even more interesting, I think. You say, wait a moment. Surely something is going to be measuring which pole, which of these two poles in the diagram a particular fullerene atom is taking. After all, the oven is somewhere around 900 to 1,000 K. There are many vibrational modes of the molecules excited. Now, maybe that wouldn't matter too much, except that some of these modes are infrared active. That means they interact with the infrared black body radiation field. And therefore, as a typical molecule goes through this, this experimental setup, it is absorbing and emitting something of the order of half a dozen infrared photons. So now, why doesn't that, in some sense, constitute a which-way measurement? And the answer is actually rather satisfying. If you actually put in the numbers, it turns out the wavelength of the infrared photon, which are emitted and absorbed, is large compared to the distance between the slits. So it's not an effective which-way measurement. And they were, the Vienna group were actually able to check this in a later experiment where they both increased the temperature of the oven and, more importantly, increased the distance between the slits. Sure enough, the interference effect went away. So it's really, really rather beautiful. But we're still at the level of something like 1,000 atoms or so. 1,000 atoms, 1,000 elementary particles composing the C60 molecule. Okay. A second set of experiments is actually rather older. It goes back to the mid-90s. This was done by David Epsilon's group on magnetic biomolecules. The molecule in question is horse spleen ferritin. And if you ask why horse spleen ferritin, I think the answer, at least in those days, was that the horse is actually much better at making the ferritin to a definite specification than a laboratory chemist was. I think since then things have improved, but in those days it was the horse that actually did it best. So these molecules are biologically important molecules. They're composed of a so-called apoferritin sheath, which is magnetically inert, and then the little green bit in the middle is a core of iron molecules which have spin. And the spins, it turns out, are mostly antiferromagnetically aligned, but there is still a slight paramagnetic tendency. That is, despite the fact that they're mostly oppositely aligned, you still have a substantial magnetic moment, something like 200 4 megatons. Now, the question is, let us suppose, it's not immediately obvious, but let's suppose, there's some evidence for this, that the only stable states are one in which you have a definite arrangement of the spins and the state which is the time reverse of that. Then the question is, now I'll denote those crudely by thick blue arrows, okay, those two states. Then the question is, could we generate and measure a quantum superposition of these two states? Well, let's ask, first of all, suppose that could indeed generate such a superposition, then what would be the effective tunneling matrix element between them? And it turns out that for an antiferromagnet in this kind of crystalline environment, there is a fairly definite answer. The tunneling matrix element is some kind of prefactor multiplied by the typical WKB type exponential. And what is significant here is that the exponent here is proportional to the total number of spins, and it also contains numbers relating to the uniaxial anisotropy and the isotropic exchange interaction. I think given the model, that conclusion is fairly firm. Now, the raw data which the Epsilon group took was, first of all, the linear susceptibility and then the noise spectrum. And what they found was that above 200 millik or so, both of these were featureless, but below about 200 millik, the sharp peak in the spectrum at around a megahertz. And they found two interesting things about this characteristic, the frequency of this characteristic resonance. First of all, it appeared to obey a Pythagorean relation when you put on a magnetic field. That's the first equation there. And secondly, the log of the frequency was constant minus Bn. Now, both of those are precisely what you'd expect for this simple model of quantum superpositions of these two macroscopically distinct states. These data, the interpretation of these data has been subjected to fairly severe criticism in the literature, and the authors have tried to respond to this, so it's not entirely clear. I would say it's not entirely clear at the moment whether they really did see the effect that they believe they saw. If they did, one thing is worth noticing about this, because it will be important later, that the measurements in this case were not on a single system, just as it was not for the Fullerian diffraction experiments. You're not looking at a single system, you're looking at a physical ensemble of many systems at the same time. In other words, you're measuring not the magnetic moment of a single molecule, but the total magnetic moment of a whole lot of molecules. So, and so that doesn't look particularly important right now, but it will become important later. The third set of systems on which this kind of experiment has been done is quantum optical systems, a beautiful set of experiments by Eugene Poulsik's group over the last few years. They were actually not specifically motivated by looking for quantum interference in macroscopically distinct states. Rather, they were interested in trying to generalize the EPR-Bell concept of entanglement to macroscopic systems. So they have two sets of cesium gas, each containing something like 10 to the 12 atoms. And you can ask what kinds of states of angular momentum could that combined system be in. Well, it turns out, we do a simple bit of algebra, that for each sample separately, and also for the total, you have the standard commutation relation of the components of angular momentum. And that then implies certain relationships for the correlations of the x and y components of angular momentum. If you can set up, therefore, a situation in which the angular momentum of 1 is exactly compensated by the angular momentum of 2, then you must have that the first two of the bottom three lines vanishes, but the last line, the expectation value, delta Jx and delta Jy total, is not zero. That's basically the macroscopic analog of the standard EPR-Bell situation. Now, they did, I won't attempt to go into the details of how they actually did the measurements and so forth and established that you were seeing a situation of this type. But what are the implications of it? Well, quantum mechanics, if you apply quantum mechanical theory to this situation, you infer that the actual spread in values of x1 of the order of n to the half, but the experiment is telling you that, this is how they got this result, I'm not going to try to go into, but they found the result that that correlation in the third, fourth line up there is zero. So that means that the fluctuation in the total Jx is zero, so x1 is exactly anticorrelated with x2. Now, that in turn means that the state is either a superposition or a mixture of states in which you have a macroscopic value of Jx for component 1 and an equal and opposite value for J2. The mixture will not give you the experimental results, so it must be a superposition, just as it must be in the standard EPR-Bell setup. And the state that you'll see, remember you're interpreting all of this by standard quantum mechanical techniques, the state you're seeing must be of the form of n up there, with an appreciable weight for n's which are of the order of n to the half. N to the half, remember, is 10 to the 6, not 10 to the 12, but 10 to the 6. So this was at least circumstantial evidence that you actually have generated a quantum superposition of macroscopically distinct states. But notice two things about it. there's no quantum mechanics is used essentially in the argument. The whole interpretation of the data is according to the rules of quantum mechanics. And secondly, the disconnectivity, as I've defined it, is not of order n, but of order n to the half. And that, I think, is probably generic to this type of experiment. It's still a very, very beautiful experiment. However, the oldest system, as it were, the one which has the longest history, and the one which has been the workhorse of this whole program, is superconducting devices. Now, of course, superconducting devices, as I'm sure you're all aware, have come to, found a new role in the last few years as possible ingredients in a quantum computer. But I think one has to remember that not all devices which are of interest for quantum computing are necessarily of interest in the context of QINDS, because some Josephson devices, for example, a standard phase qubit, doesn't really involve the superposition of macroscopic limiting states. However, there are certain kinds which certainly are interesting in this context, and one of them is the one illustrated here, which is what, in the old days, we used to call this an RF squid, and nowadays people usually call it a flux qubit. It's a single ring, superconducting ring, interrupted with one, or in some cases more, Josephson junctions. And if you're not familiar with Josephson junctions, just think of it as a sort of gate, which will allow pairs of electrons to penetrate, but with increased difficulty. Now, the advantages, the macroscopic variable that we're going to look at in this case is the trapped flux, phi, or equivalently the circulating current in the two states. The advantages of this kind of system are many. First of all, the classical dynamics of the macroscopic variable, the trapped flux or the current, is believed to be very well understood. The intrinsic dissipation can be made extremely low. Let me just give you an example of that, because I find it quite a surprising observation. These rings are actually often rather small, but let's be somewhat expansive and consider a ring which has dimensions of the order of a centimetre. Okay? So you've got a centimetre's worth of, say, niobium, a typical superconductor. And I'm going to take that superconducting ring, and I'm going to take it down to a temperature, let's say, of 5 millik. Not routine, but not at all difficult these days to get it down to that kind of temperature. Okay, now the most obvious source of dissipation in that superconducting ring is the normal electrons, the ones that are not part of the Cooper pairs. In that niobium superconducting ring at 5 millik, I'm not going to ask you what is the fraction of normal electrons, I'm going to ask you how many normal electrons are there. And the answer is quite surprising. The answer is zero. Or, to put it more precisely, the average number is something like 10 to the minus dot, dot, dot. Okay? So there simply are no normal electrons in that device. And this, of course, is a large part of the reason why these devices have been able to become considered so seriously as possible elements in a quantum computer. Again, we have a well-defined, well-developed technology for coupling this system together and so on and so forth, and perhaps most importantly, in the present context, the action, which is a measure of tunneling matrix elements and so forth, doesn't scale with D. You can make D very large, the disconnectivity very large, and still preserve a reasonable value of the action so that you get reasonable tunneling frequencies. Okay, I think we can skip these two in front of the audience. Let me just skip to this one. Let's imagine we put this superconducting ring in an external magnetic flux. What are the possible states? Well, I won't go into the derivation of this. It's relatively straightforward. But you find that for such a simple superconducting ring, remember, for the moment, we haven't got a Josephson junction yet. Okay? We've got a simple superconducting ring, and there is a quantization condition for a particle of charge 2e. Now, the basic objects in terms of which we describe the superconducting state are Cooper pairs, that is, pairs of electrons, so they have charge 2e. And the quantization condition is that the circulation k, integral VdL, is h over 2m times some integer n minus the flux in units of the flux quantum h over 2. Let's look at the implications of that. Furthermore, the energy of the state is proportional to the square of the circulation, as you might expect. It's just kinetic energy, basically. So first of all, let's consider the Boring case, where the external flux is zero. Then, obviously, I think it's fairly obvious that the only way to minimize the energy is to set n equal to zero, so all your pairs are at rest. That's very boring, no interest in this context. The interesting case is where the flux, the external flux, is half a flux quantum. In that case, the ground state is doubly degenerate, corresponding to n equals zero or n equals one. You can very easily verify that gives you the same value of the energy. So at this level of description, then, we have two possible ground states, which are degenerate. In one of them, all the pairs are rotating clockwise, and the other state, they're rotating anticlockwise. Now, of course, you might ask the obvious question, why is a state with 50% doing one thing and 50% doing the other forbidden? And crudely speaking, the answer is that the moment Cooper pairs are formed, the energetic considerations force them to all behave in exactly the same way. It's much like the phenomenon of Bose condensation. And you can give the arguments are not totally trivial, but there are rather convincing arguments you can give in favour of that conclusion. So you can't have a 50-50 situation. Either all your pairs have to be circulating one clockwise or all anticlockwise. And now you might think about trying to generate a quantum superposition of those two states, but it turns out that the tunneling matrix element would just be incredibly small for a simple ring like that. So that's why you just pretty it up a little by putting in your Josephson junction in your ring. And now it turns out that the energy barrier between these two states is not that fantastically high, and you can reasonably think of generating quantum superpositions. So what you're going to try to do then is to generate a quantum superposition of states in which all your electrons are circulating clockwise and one in which they're circulating anticlockwise. And very typically in existing experiments, the actual value of the circulating currents is something like a microamp. Now, the original experiments, which were done in 2000 at SUNY and Delft, were spectroscopic in nature. It turns out, if you apply quantum mechanics to this situation, you can ask, what would the energy levels of this system be like? First of all, on the hypothesis that you simply had a classical mixture of these two states, and secondly, on the assumption you had a quantum superposition. You're plotting the energy as a function of the external flux, and the middle of the diagram up there corresponds to exactly half the flux quantum. So it turns out, and it's very simple to work out, if you believe you've got a classical mixture of these two states, then the energy levels are rather boring, they're just the pink black lines in that diagram. If, on the other hand, you believe you have a quantum superposition, then, according to quantum mechanics, you get the standard level repulsion effect, and you find the green solid lines. The experiment was done, and in both cases, they found essentially the green solid lines. So that, at least, is circumstantial evidence that you really do get quantum superpositions of these two different states. More spectacular experimental evidence has come in slightly more recently. In these experiments, which have been a number in different laboratories, you actually look for real-time oscillations between the two states, very similar to the oscillations of an ammonia molecule between its two possible configurations. In the language of quantum optics, these are Ramsey Fritch experiments, in fact. And I'm just going to show you very briefly an experimental graph from the experimental paper, from one of the experimental papers. This is actually a diagram or a plot of the Ramsey fringes. You might think that the ups and downs correspond to the system actually oscillating between the two states, but actually that's not true. The actual oscillation frequency is much higher than this. I won't go into the details of the interpretation of this diagram, but I'm just showing you have, as it were, real data here. When you actually work out the number of real oscillations between the two states which are taking place, well, what might you have guessed? If I'd been asked to guess about the outcome of this kind of experiment way back in, say, 1999, I'd have said you'll be very lucky if you get more than two or three coherent oscillations. In fact, in real life, they get up to 500 or so. It's really spectacular. It's one of these cases where nature, as it were, behaves much better than you thought she would. Well, okay, so these are, so roughly speaking, there are other examples as well, but these are perhaps the most obvious examples of experiments which have looked for and apparently found evidence for quantum superposition of macroscopically distinct states. But now we have to raise the question, how macroscopically distinct? What is the disconnectivity, or if you like, the Schrödinger's cattiness of the states involved in the existing QIMDS experiments? Well, in some cases, this is a relatively straightforward question to answer. In the fullerene diffraction experiments, well, the number of particles which are behaving differently in the two branches of your superposition is simply the total number of elementary particles in a fullerene molecule, and that's of the order of 1,000, 1,200 actually, more like 1,200. In the magnetic biomolecule experiments, similarly, the number of microscopic objects which are behaving differently in the two branches of the superposition, crudely speaking, the number of elementary iron spins which reverse themselves. Again, we know what that is, it's about 5,000. So. Unfortunately, in the other experiments, which in some sense are more, in some ways more spectacular, the question of how many particles are behaving differently is, to some extent at least, a matter of definition. And to illustrate that, let's consider the squid experiment and put in the numbers from one of the earliest experiments, the Sioni-Stanyhol experiment. So how many microscopic entities are behaving differently in the two branches of your superposition? Well, first of all, let's take a naive approach and just describe the two states in terms of the behavior of the Cooper pairs. Then, crudely speaking, you have different Cooper pair states, chi clockwise and chi anticlockwise, and each of these states is shared by n over 2 Cooper pairs. And so if you take that as an appropriate definition of the number of particles behaving differently, then you find that disconnectivity is the order of the total number of Cooper pairs, which is, it turns out to be, for these experiments, of the order of 10 to the 9 or 10 to the 10. However, unfortunately, there's a bit of a mistake there. This argument, I think, would be convincing if you could actually paint electrons or Cooper pairs individually. Then you could say, well, you know, each of these is behaving differently in the two states. Alas, the Cooper pairs are made of electrons, the electrons obey Fermi statistics. So that complicates the counting. And so you can ask the question, and of course back at Allen in a recent paper, which is now published, did ask the question, how many single electrons do we need to displace in momentum space to get from one state to the other? And they calculated that, and it turns out that it's indeed the total number n of Cooper pairs, but multiplied now by a rather small ratio, which is the ratio of the superfluid velocity corresponding to the two circulating states and the Fermi velocity. And they came up, therefore, with the answer that the disconnectivity is, or whatever one wants to call it, the figure of merit, is only of the order of 10 to the 3 or 10 to the 4. Now, okay, at first sight that seems a convincing argument, but I think there are reasons one might doubt it. One reason one might doubt it is imagine that we went through the so-called PCS-BEC crossover and we tightened our Cooper pairs gradually until they became basically like simple diatomic molecules. If they're simple diatomic molecules, they're either going to be both condensed in one circulating state or the other. And in that case, I think most of us would say without a qualm that the number of particles behaving differently is more like 10 to the 9 or 10 to the 10. So let's just take Korsbeck and et al.'s criterion seriously for a moment. Let's do an amusing thought experiment. When would we call two states? Incidentally, Korsbeck and et al. Make the remark to the effect that, okay, they get a number of the order of 10 to the 3, 10 to the 4, and they say this number is really not what we could call mesoscopically or macroscopically large. Okay, so now let me put the question to you. When would you count two states as intuitively macroscopically distinct? And I'll propose a possible answer. I would say it's reasonable to say, we can treat two states as macroscopically distinct, if they can actually be told apart with the unaided human eye in normal visual conditions, no microscopes, anything like that, over a time of the order of, say, a second. People think that's reasonable? You don't want to violently disagree with that suggested criterion? No. Okay. So let's just take that and see where it leads us. Well, imagine that I'm going to have to go over this now. What I'm now going to imagine is that we have a little speck of, and the speck, let us say, for definiteness, is made of lithium fluoride. And we will ask, what is the smallest speck of lithium fluoride, such that by just observing it with the naked eye, we can tell apart the states where it's stationary on the one hand, and on the other hand, moving over a distance equal to its own diameter in the period of a second. There is an answer to that question which I obtained from a colleague who is an expert in experimental psychophysics. I won't give you that answer right out now. So let's now ask ourselves, okay, let's take that minimal lithium fluoride particle, and let's ask, okay, how many electrons did we actually, or how many elementary particles did we actually have to displace to go from the stationary state to the moving state? We believe that the electrons in lithium fluoride occupy energy bands and so forth, so when the speck is at rest, you have a nice symmetrically filled energy band there. And when it's moving, in some sense the band is shifted, so to get from one state to the other, you have to take some electrons off one end of the band and put them over the other end of the band. Okay? And so we can ask how many particles we have to displace, and the answer is of the order of the total number of electrons there, but multiplied by this factor V0, divided by what I call VF, which is basically just a characteristic velocity for the band. It's not a Fermi velocity, but it's a characteristic velocity for the band. And that's very similar to the answer we got for the squid. I won't tell you what that number is for a moment. But now you say, well, wait a minute, you've only thought about the electrons. What about the nuclei? After all, you also have to count them when you go from one state to the other. You've got to displace those. Now, it turns out that the nuclear velocity, the mean square nuclear velocity, is actually much lower than the Fermi velocity of the electrons, not surprisingly. So if we were to just ask how many nuclei do we have to displace, the answer is, again, the factor of n missing there, but should be the order of V0 divided by the root mean square nuclear velocity. And that number now comes out to be much larger than the number we got from the electrons. Now, wait a moment. Should we really be doing that? Should we think in terms of the nuclei, or rather, should we think in terms of the individual nucleons? Now, the individual nucleons in the nucleus are moving much, much faster than the nuclei moving as a whole. So what we should really be putting in there is not V0 over Vn, but V0 over what I call Vp, the velocity of, let us say, a single proton in the nucleus. And that's much smaller than the electron. That gives us a value much smaller than the electron contribution. But when I actually give you the numerical answer that I get, you're going to say, well, you cheated. You cheated because, really, when you've got your nucleons confined within a nucleus, it really doesn't make sense to talk about the motion of the nucleons as a whole. You really have to think in terms of the nuclei. Okay? Fair enough. But if that's true, then you also cheated with the squid, because you counted in terms of single electrons, whereas we should be thinking in terms of Cooper pairs. After all, the Cooper pair is a perfectly good composite object. Okay? If you do that, you come up with a much more respectable number than squid, which is something like 10 to the 6th, 10 to the 7th. However, the real point of this thought experiment is a bit different. Suppose we do take the Korsbeck et al. Criterion seriously and apply it to this smallest visible dust particle. What number do we get? Remember that for the squid we got a number of the order of 5,000. What do we get for this situation, which we've all agreed, or I hope we've all agreed, is does correspond to two macroscopically distinct states. The answer is about two. So in other words, by the Korsbeck et al. Criterion, the squid, the superposition of states in the squid is much more macroscopic than what we've already agreed is a case of macroscopic superposition. But of course, as I said, in some sense you're cheating in both cases. Well, if you don't cheat, what do you get? Well, if you don't cheat, then for the squid you get something like 10 to the 6, 10 to the 7. For the dust particle you get something like 10 to the 5. So again, you've reached the conclusion that this squid does involve states whose difference is more macroscopic than those of the dust particle. It's really quite amusing, the conclusion. However, I have to say that I think that probably the interest of making very precise definitions here is limited, and one probably shouldn't spend too much of one's life trying to do it. Well, okay, let's just review where we are. Taking various systems here, and I asked what are these two numbers that we put in the two columns. Remember the extensive difference, the difference in the value of some macroscopic quantity between the two branches of the superposition, and the other column is this connectivity, which is this rather vague concept of how many particles are behaving differently. For a single electron, trivially, both those are one. For the neutron interferometer, this first number, the extensive difference, is very large, it's the order of 10 to the 9, but you're only talking about a single particle, so the disconnectivity is only one. For the kind of quantum electrodynamic cavities, which, for example, Serge Roche has done some very beautiful experiments, both those numbers are about 10. You're superposing states in which, crudely speaking, about 10 photons are behaving differently. A Cooper pair box, a favorite ingredient in computing, quantum computing applications and superconducting devices, extensive difference is quite large, about 10 to the 5. You've actually taken a single Cooper pair and moved it a fair distance. But again, you're only talking about a single Cooper pair, so that the second number is only 2. Fullerenes, as we've already said, about 1100, 1200. Ferritin, about 5000. The Orbis quantum optics experiments, about 10 to the 6. The SUNY squid experiments, well, as we saw, the first number, the extensive difference, is certainly about 10 to the 9, 10 to the 10. If you're prepared to take, now you do, to make that number work, to make that number valid, as it were, you do have to take as your extensive quantity, not the circulating current, but the magnetic moment. And you might say, well, it might be cheating somewhat, but as a matter of opinion, I think. If you take the magnetic moment, then certainly 10 to the 9, 10 to the 10. And again, then we could argue about the figure in the other column. Now, beneath this, I've put the smallest visible dust particle, and at first sight, that's confusing, because I already told you that that had a surprisingly small value of these numbers. What I was thinking of when I originally wrote this view graph was a quite different situation, in which you're actually inspecting the particle at two very different positions and so forth, and not asking about its state of motion. So I now want to something to revise that number. For a real-life cat, the numbers come out to be something like 10 to the 34 in that column and 10 to the 25. But again, you know, it's several, you can order about one or two orders of magnitude each way there. But however we look at this, I think what we can say is we certainly come on a logarithmic scale something like 40% of the way between an atom and a real-life cat. So it's not entirely trivial. Let me just very briefly discuss where systems in which one might perhaps look for macroscopic superpositions. There has been considerable discussion of the possibility of looking for them in Bose-Einstein condensates and ultra-cold alkali gases. These share some of the attractive features of squids, in particular that you get a sort of, well, in this case you get a real, genuine Bose condensation into a single state. So you can consider two different possibilities. The ordinary Gross-Pitayevsky state is one in which all your atoms are in a superposition of states of being in the left and the right. So that is not a Schrödinger's cat-like state at all. The Schrödinger's cat-like state may be favoured if the interactions are sufficiently attractive between your atoms, and yet not too attractive that you don't want to get them decaying. And that's of the second form. Help. I'm sorry, I forgot you haven't been able to see the view. Someone should have shown that. The last. Okay. So the first state up there is the ordinary Gospodarsky state, and that's not particularly interesting. The second state is the Schrodinger cat state, which is interesting from our point of view, and that will be favoured if the interaction is sufficiently radical. And so people have discussed the possibility of looking for quantum interference between these macroscopic distinct states. There are, however, some problems, I think, which don't occur with the squid case. First of all, the whole experiment is extremely sensitive to the well asymmetry in a way that the squids are really not. The energy stabilizing the argument of the two components, the relative argument of A over B, is of the order of T to the N, where T is the single particle tunneling matrix element, and that's exponentially small. So delta E, the energy difference between the two wells needs to be exponentially small in N. And that's not going to be too easy to meet in practice. The second question is, how are we going to actually detect that we really do have a superposition rather than a mixture? And the trouble is that people normally think of tomography as a way of doing this, but tomography becomes very, very difficult if you're dealing with n very large compared to 1. In this case, it might be typically the order of, say, 10 to the 7 or 10 to the 8. So I think that implies that if you're going to do that experiment, you'd better try to do it in the same way as been done with squids, that is to look for, to do time sequence experiments, Ramsey fringe experiments, if you like. But the trouble is then that the period is very sensitive to the exact value of n, which is almost certainly not going to be reproducible from shot to shot. This is, I think, a general problem with these ultra-cold atomic gas implementations, that that you have, they're much less robust against, in some sense, minor experimental variations than is the case with the squid. Finally, let me just briefly comment on another system which people are very interested in, which is MEMS, micro-electromechanical systems. The idea here is that you might take a small vibrating mechanical system and look for superpositions of different quantum states in that. And I've just given you a few typical experimental parameters there. It's tempting to think of the picture of the top one there, where the bar is actually vibrating over an amplitude which is large compared to its width. In real life, that's almost certainly unrealistic. The bar is going to be vibrating over a very small distance compared to its width. And in fact, if you put in the numbers, right now it seems very unlikely that you're ever going to be able to get a displacement, delta x, which is more than a few zero-point amplitudes of your vibration. Okay, so that, I mean, it is interesting because the center of mass does in some sense have a special role. And in fact, it may be that the best way to test certain scenarios which are alternative to quantum mechanics, certain macro-realistic scenarios like that of GRWP or Penrose, may be to use these systems. But nevertheless, I think in some sense one could say in terms of the absolute numbers involved, these systems right now are quite a long way behind some of the other systems I've mentioned. But progress is being made rather fast, almost. Okay, so let's ask, what have we seen so far? If we interpret the raw data in quantum mechanical terms, then we can reasonably conclude that at the kinds of level which I've been talking about, the level of fullerenes, fullerene diffraction, of quantum optical systems, of squids and so forth, we do appear to have a quantum superposition rather than a mixture of macroscopic distinct states. And that already, I think, is quite an important conclusion. People sometimes object to this, that it's not terribly interesting, because even though you have this very large number of microscopic particles, nevertheless, in general, there's only a single degree of freedom involved. For example, in the fullerene experiments, what you're actually looking at is superposition of different states at the center of mass, with the internal states really not doing anything different in the two states. And you have to really decide for yourself whether you think that's a significant difference or a significant criticism or not. Now, the next question you can ask is, do the data exclude the general hypothesis of macro-realism? Which, remember, is the statement that at this kind of level, things have to do one thing or the other. They can't be in a quantum superposition. And the answer is no. No experiment, to my knowledge at least, has yet excluded the general class of macro-realistic theories. Well, given that, then do the data exclude specific macro-realistic theories, for example, GRWP or Penrose or whatever? Again, I'm afraid the answer is no. In the case of the Fullerene diffraction, n is not large enough for the differences to become apparent. In the case of the squids, you have a large difference, but alas, the centre of mass is not really doing anything different in the two states. And since in GRWP, it's the centre of mass which makes the behaviour of the centre of mass which is essential, that means that it would not predict anything different for the squid experiments, as of now. Now, I do have a student who's looking at the possibility of printing out these experiments so that they get a macroscopic displacement of the centre of mass, but so far that's not been done. Would the MEMS experiments, if they came out in agreement with quantum mechanics, exclude GRWP? Well, unfortunately there the prospect is somewhat bleak, because the collapse rate predicted in GRW theory goes as delta x, the displacement of the bar, whereas the decoherence rate in standard quantum mechanics goes as delta x squared. So you don't actually gain by going to larger delta x, and smaller, if you go to small enough delta x, you may not get off the ground, it may not be enough to produce substantial differences between the predictions of GRWP and quantum mechanics. Very, very brief note, there is something I think which is rather important in this area. I've invoked on the last view graph the standard quantum mechanical decoherence rate. But what does the theory for that rest on? Well, basically there are two stages in the theory. First of all, you've got to convince yourself that your environment, whatever it may be, is adequately modelled by an oscillator bath. And secondly, you've got to eliminate the environment, for example, by standard Feynman Verlin techniques. And if you do, then you get out a fairly standard expression for the decoherence rate of some macroscopic object like this bar. And what's interesting about that result is that the decoherence rate is the energy relaxation rate multiplied by two factors, which in general are going to be very large. One is kT over h bar omega, the number of excited phonons, basically, and the second is delta x over x0, where delta x is the actual displacement, x0 is the zero-point displacement. Now, question, can we be sure of that result? I think the second stage in the calculation, that is the elimination of the environment, is almost certainly foolproof, but the first one could be questionable, and I think we do need to think more in more detail about the generality of the oscillator bath model. I think that this is in some sense a rather generic problem in the whole area of testing quantum mechanics at the macroscopic level. Well, where do we go from here? Most obvious prospect, just go to larger values of lambda or do. Just do diffraction with heavier and heavier molecules, maybe with a virus, etc., etc. I don't think that's terribly interesting, because one's simply looking at superpositions of different states of the centre of mass in all these cases. I don't think there's any particular reason to believe there's going to be anything very exciting happening on that front. Second possibility, look for either more sophisticated forms of entanglement, the sort of thing that Scott Aronson, for example, has suggested, or look for superpositions of states involving, for example, different biological functionalities. For example, one might look at, one might attempt to look, this is very, I think, a distant future project, but one might look, tend to look at superpositions of the triggered and untriggered states of rhodopsin in the human eye. That's the first stage of the human visual process, and so one might be able to create superpositions of that type, in principle at least, and look for them. But I think the most interesting possibility is to exclude macro-realism. You remember we have not excluded macro-realism so far. What we've done so far is to see that at the level in question, let's say the level of squids, everything is consistent with quantum mechanics still working. I'm a Popperian in my philosophy of science. I don't believe that any finite number of experiments could ever prove that quantum mechanics is right. However, I do believe that with all the ifs and buts put in, a finite number of experiments could prove either quantum mechanics or alternative class of theories to be wrong. So rather than try to prove that quantum mechanics is right at a particular level, why don't we rather try to prove that a class of alternative theories is wrong? So let's just have a brief look at that to finish up. We can define a class of macro-realistic theories as follows. Suppose we have, for example, our squid ring, and we denote the clockwise circulating state of Q equals plus 1 and the anticlockwise one by minus 1. Now, We know already, there have already been experiments which tell us that whenever we actually observe the system to see which way that round the current is circulating, it's always one or the other. So when observed, Q is always plus one or minus one. Let us now make, as a basic ingredient in our macrorealistic theory, the statement that Q of T is plus or minus one at almost all times, whether or not it's observed. I have to say almost all because obviously you need to allow for basic transit times between the two, but you can do that, and you can limit the possible magnitude of those times. Turns out that by itself is not enough to give it a decent experimental test. Supplemented by two other principles. One is non-invasive measurability, namely that in principle at least I can do an experiment which within the context of a macro-realistic theory will not disturb the system or its subsequent behaviour. That, of course, is not a quantum mechanical principle. This is a macro-realistic principle. Okay? And then there's an argument then about how you might actually try to make that plausible, which I could go into if anyone's interested. And the third possibility is induction, namely that the arrow of time runs roughly the way we thought it did from past to future. Given those, you can actually write down a prediction for a macro-realistic theory, and many of you, I'm sure, are familiar with the EPR Bell setup, and this is just, in some sense, a transcription of the so-called CHSH inequality to this different situation. So the formal structure of the inequality is identical to that of CHSH. The interpretation, however, is quite different, because the variables that occur in here are not the different settings of polarizer angles, they're rather the outcomes of measurements at different times. And so, so in place of the polarizer angle, you've actually got the times sitting in here. But you can, the algebra is basically identical to that of CHSH inequality. And in particular, if you take this particular selection of times, then you can very easily establish that for any macro-realistic theory, k is less than or equal to 2. And that's actually true for any times, but maybe a convenient one. If you do the calculation for an ideal quantum mechanical state, two-state system, then you find, again, just as in WPR, that k is 2.8. And if you do, now, the real question is, what happens if you do quantum mechanics, but take it seriously? That is, you describe the system realistically, your experimental system realistically, as interacting with an environment subject to internal dissipation, dot, 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 all the real-life complications. Well, then, I mean, we've done lots of calculations have been done on that system over the last 20 years or so. And I think there's general agreement that although k is never going to be quite as big as 2.8, it can still be substantially larger than 2 with reasonable values of experimental parameters. Therefore, to the extent that the analysis of possibility C within quantum mechanics is reliable, you can actually do an experiment to force nature to choose between macro-realism and quantum mechanics. Now, it's a difficult experiment. It's, in some sense, conceptually, it's a very simple generalization of the experiments that have been done to date, but the requirements are much, much tighter. The requirements, for example, on fidelity of measurement and so forth are much, much tighter than they have been in existing experiments. Because remember, in existing experiments, you are merely trying to prove that, whether or not you say quantum mechanics is right, at least everything is consistent with quantum mechanics. Here, you're trying to rigorously exclude a class of alternative theories, so that imposes much, much tighter constraints on the fidelities and so forth. And although that's not been reached yet, I think people have made a lot of progress in this direction. I think that experiment will be done within the next 5 or 10 years. Possible outcomes? Well, first, the most boring possible outcome is that you discover all sorts of unsuspected noise, as a result of which even the quantum mechanical calculation that tells you that k should be less than 2, no longer any contradiction with the macro-realistic theory. Well, yes, but I'm pretty confident that my experimental colleague will soon go away and remove most of those unwanted sources of noise. So I think that's not a major roadblock. Possibility B, the experiment is done, we find that indeed k is greater than 2, whereupon that does, I think, pretty definitively knock out macro-realism at the particular level in question. And you say, okay, well, what's the big deal? Well, the big deal, I think, in some sense, is we've shown that these very counterintuitive features of quantum mechanics don't just occur at the level of single atoms, they occur at a level which is at least 40% along the road to our own direct consciousness. Well, I don't think that's entirely trivial. Possibility number 3 is that the experiment is done and it turns out that k is less than 2. And then, of course, the roof falls in on the whole operation, and we could discuss what exactly is going to happen in under those circumstances. But what I think you can be pretty sure of is that even if it turns out that my hunch that macro realism is actually right and quantum mechanics is wrong, even if that hunch is correct, no one is ever going to agree to that conclusion within my lifetime. So I think if it were to turn out the experiments came out in this very unexpected way, it would certainly be only the beginning of a long, long story about plugging all the loopholes and so on and so forth. But I think, nevertheless, it's one of these projects which may or may not actually, in the end, produce something surprising. You learn enough interesting things along the way that the whole effort will not have been a waste of time. So hopefully I've given you some kind of idea of how this class of experiments has been going over the last 10 years and how they might go over in the next decade or so. Thank you.
So, yeah, first of all, let me apologize for the external source of decoherence that Tony dealt with very well. Do we have questions?
Any theory of the macro realistic class would predict that K is less than C. If it covers GRWP, it covers Penrose, it covers I should be a little careful about that. It covers GRWP, Penrose, ... at a certain level of macroscopicness. And what that level of macroscopicness is may well depend on individual theory. For example, as I mentioned, in the case of the squids, GRWP at least would be consistent with the quantum mechanical prediction K greater than 2. And that's because you've not yet generated a relative displacement in central mass.
Can I ask you, since this is an experiment that you have to do at each different level, each different size of system, is there a size at which you would give up? You know, if quantum theory just continues to be true for n equals to ? What size would?
I think I would give up when it comes to the level of my own consciousness, basically. That's right. Okay. First of all, I wouldn't totally agree, I think, with your final statement, because in this class of experiments, yes, I think one would always find that the action is in order h bar. I don't think that the sort of statement that Niels Bohr was rather fond of making, that quantum mechanics is going to reduce to classical mechanics as soon as S becomes larger than units of h bar, is universally true. I mean, I think you can find exceptions to that statement. But anyway, a more interesting point is that, why don't I use the action, sorry. The problem is, let me answer this indirectly by, I've never been using this argument before, I'm not sure, but perhaps other people haven't heard it. In some sense, the question is, isn't my criterion for when interesting things are going to happen, when quantum mechanics may break down, very arbitrary? And the answer is, in a sense, is yes, but let me just give you the following analogy. Suppose that you, one of us with our 21st century knowledge of physics, is somehow projected back in a time machine into the late 19th century. And so, armed with 21st century physics, we go out and buttonhole our colleagues and tell them that, you're all believing in what they call, of course, stuff mechanics. From our point of view, it's classical mechanics. You're all believing in mechanics as an ultimate theory about the world. I can tell you that your mechanics is going to break down when the product of energy and time becomes of the order of 10 to the minus 34 joule seconds. And they look at you and say, oh, no, sorry, old man, not going to work, not going to work. You see, it's obvious that mechanics tolerates no scope. You know, there just is no concept of a characteristic scope in mechanics. True, absolutely true, in classical mechanics. Not true anymore in quantum mechanics. So the point I'm making here is that something which looks totally arbitrary and very inelegant, as it were, from the point of view of the old theory, may in fact turn out to play a major role in the new theory. So the idea that simply the number of elementary particles which are behaving differently in two branches might be important, that of course is totally alien to quantum mechanics. Quantum mechanics, and you could, you know, quantum mechanics doesn't even really distinguish between individual particle and collective degrees of freedom. The formula is exactly the same. But that is not to say that in a new theory that may not play a role. Now, the fact that it is that particular variable which is playing a role and not something more sophisticated, for example, the sort of variable that Scott Aaronson has considered, that, of course, is just a guess. It's just a guess. Its main function is to motivate a certain direction of the experiments, which I think it, to some extent, has done. But I think more generally, if and when we get a new theory coming in which supersedes quantum mechanics, then things which look very arbitrary from the point of view of quantum mechanics look totally natural from the point of view of the new theory.